Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the world's allegedly least corrupt country in the world. And we know that it's really not corrupt because most of the judges are related. Am I very amazing, spectacular, somewhat magnanimous guest is Nancy Duterte. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I think I am somewhat magnanimous. That's true.
Yeah. I like to be accurate. It's a journalism thing. And I'd like to just get you to introduce yourself to the audience, those who aren't aware of you, and we'll just get on with the discussion.
Introduce myself. Well, Nancy Duterte. I'm known as the Skeptical Psychic. I can always be found at theskepticalpsychic.com. I am the nutshell version is I'm an attorney who made a very stunning detour and became a trained psychic detective, medium, medical intuitive, energy healer, remote viewer, paranormal investigator, author, teacher, lecturer, and former CBS radio show host. How's that?
Quite the litany. It's fantastic. Okay. What's on your mind today? Because I know you've been out working a whole lot, been on tours and stuff like that. What's been going on for you recently?
You know, I think, well, the most recent thing is I was a presenter up at a UFO conference called Experiencers Speak 2014. It was up in Portland, Maine. And it was absolutely just shocking, informative, magnificent. It was really much more than I expected. I had a really good reception up there also. Sold out of my book, Psychic Intuition, so that was a good thing. And also I attended another UFO conference over the weekend down in New York City. So I think I'm sort of on a UFO track right now. Also, remote viewing track, but primarily, I would say UFO.
Where does the psychic and the alien kind of is there a bridge between them, or is there like a clear separation?
That's a great question, and I have to tell you that you know in going into this whole thing, because as you know, I sort of have gone into everything backwards. I didn't start out psychic, didn't come from a psychic family, nothing genetic. We never talked about anything like this. And then I sort of walked into it, but through training, you know, not as something that I just did. And then I was absolutely positive that there was no relationship really between the psychic stuff and paranormal stuff. And when I say paranormal, I mean like, you know, ghosts and spirits and all that. And it took me a long time to slowly get into the paranormal field. And by the time I did that, I was absolutely, I mean, I was just positive. There was no relationship between psychic stuff, paranormal stuff on the one hand, and UFO stuff on the other. And what I kind of, and again, I sort of fell into it somewhat backwards. I've had a few, I would say, UFO-related experiences in my life, but like anything else, I completely discounted them. I had an experience that there was no way to discount it. I mean, my daughter and I both witnessed a mothership, and we watched it for quite a while. It was the size of a football field. It was all lit up with orange lights. It was about a half a mile away, 500 to 1,000 feet up in the sky. It was just, I've never seen anything that huge. And it was sitting there, no noise, no nothing. And it emanated this, it was like a giant white orb. And the light was completely unlike any light I've ever seen in the sky. It was luminescent and solid white, and it didn't reflect off the clouds the way all the other lights do. And it didn't have little radiating beams the way any, if you look up, you know, any airplane or anything that we fly in the sky has lights that have little rays coming off of them when you look at them. This not at all. It was probably about 15 to 20 feet in diameter, and it kind of circled it curlicued around this giant boomerang-shaped mothership, went behind it, came back, reattached itself, and then the entire craft either shielded or dematerialized in three phases. The wings went first, then the midsection, and then the central part, and it was like you just, you know, with your remote, you just turned off a TV set. It didn't fly away. So anyway, so when we both saw that, and you sort of can't, it changes everything. And I started on my former show, Hot Leads Cold Cases, I started interviewing people involved in ufology in the UFO field. And I started to realize the more I talked to people, the more I read, there's a connection. And there is, it's your question is great, because the presentation that I gave up in Maine had to do with exolinguistics. It's basically, how do you talk to an alien? And I do believe, I'm absolutely 100% convinced that all of my training in this psychic and paranormal field is extremely useful to the UFO field, where a lot of times the people who are involved in either contact or abductions, that kind of thing, they may have some psychic background, or they may become psychic as a result of their experiences, but a lot of times they're not. So they're skills that I know can be taught, and that's sort of what I was hoping to let people know.
I've got this idea as well that psychic potential is kind of exists within all of us. And I think as children, it's really intense and they simply get browbeaten out of it. Oh, no, you know, don't talk about that or anything. And they just stop seeing it after a while by denying that it's there.
I think it's even more subtle than that. I mean, yeah, you're right. People do get browbeaten out of it. And then I have taught many, many, many students who wanted to get their abilities back, who will tell, you know, that exact story. You know, oh, when I was a little kid, everybody told me I was crazy. They ran away from me. They were frightened. My parents told me to be quiet, you know, stop talking, stop saying that so-and-so, you know, has a health issue or that they're pregnant or that they're going to die. You know, so people get frightened, that's for sure. But I think there's another piece of it, which is that in the way that we learn how to speak, and this goes back to language, by the way, when you speak, there's a syntax and there's an organization, there's a structure, a grammar, and you have to go from, it's sequential. So you go from point A to point B when you, you know, say a sentence. Okay. And by the time you get to the end of the sentence, you've used up a certain amount of time and energy, and particularly time, since it's linear. when you're getting into the psychic field and you're getting into holistic knowledge, you're bypassing that and it gets much, much, much faster. So you can take in a huge amount of information and you can convey a huge amount of information because it's not linear. Do you see what I'm saying?
It, sort of like if you see a movie like Fight Club, for instance, and then you watch it the second time and you suddenly notice all the subtle nuances that actually kind of gave you the end of the plot, sort of like that?
First, I love Fight Club, and I've probably seen that 50 times. I keep looking at the subtle nuances. It has more to do with actual, not so much looking at the nuances. It has to do with
listening out, watching for the signs. I remember one time, Nancy, I was coming up from my car up to my apartment, and I go past the washing line, and all my washing's dry, and a little part of my brain says, Vinny, get down all that washing, it's going to rain. And I go, nah, I'm not going to listen to it. And I get up, and as soon as I get up to my apartment, boom, starts raining.
Yeah, because otherwise you would have to sit around, you'd have to maybe listen to a news report, you'd have to have somebody, you know, in authority or know that you're looking at thunderclouds and they're way out in the horizon. You know, you'd have to do research, an investigation, you have to put together your data. That all takes time. And the same thing, I guess I'm talking more about telepathy. If you convey a message to somebody by speaking, it takes time to get from the beginning of the sentence to the end of the sentence. That's time. Well, you can convey information, you know, like the speed of light, probably faster, actually, if you're using this more holistic sense of psychic communication. Because you can, it's like, you know, the expression, a picture's worth a thousand words?
Yeah.
It's the same idea. Same basic idea.
Is there a possibility that there's some kind of agenda to quell psychic abilities? Is it seen as a threat or a military or otherwise?
I don't know. Every once in a while, I'm intrigued by the simultaneous lack of intrigue and the over intensely focus on such things. So I couldn't tell you.
What about weaponization? Because that's what I always found about things that are really amazing and can be used for benefit or medical treatments and things like that, is that there's always some group of scumbags that goes, man, this is really amazing. It's so wonderful. Let's weaponize it.
Well, I mean, it has been weaponized, of course.
Well, in what way has those psychic abilities been weaponized?
I think I told you that one of my mentors was Ingo Swann. He is known as he just passed away a year ago. He's known as the father of remote viewing. Remote viewing, he developed it for the CIA. So it's a psychic spy program. And it was originally done allegedly because the U.S. was afraid that Russia had gotten a little bit too advanced in the psychic field and that we were falling behind. So they put a fair amount of money, not a ton of money into it. I mean, over 20 years, I think it was not much more than about 22, 23 million. And then they dropped it very suddenly. And basically, I mean, that program has just gone, it's been privatized, so it's gone underground to some extent. But, you know, if you talk to any of the remote viewers, of course, not only, it can be weaponized in the sense of spying, and it can be weaponized in a much more, in relation to things like, you know, health or, you know, the human body. So, yeah, it's, you know, in the same way that people dismiss, you know, things as like voodoo and stuff like that, or putting, you know, pins into a voodoo doll and saying, well, that's going to affect whoever the victim is. There's some very interesting ways that people have, you know, used this in not such good ways. And I certainly know remote viewers who have been asked to use their skills in negative ways, and who have refused.
What kind of things, like messing with somebody's head, whispering into them, "I'm behind you," you know, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, people have experienced that. I don't know whether they've been asked to go be behind people, certainly to look at what people are doing, of course. Worse than that.
You know what I'd do? If I had an underground psychic program or something like that, I'd be messing with all the people that are in control of everything and trying to dominate them using my above the law, you know, top secret clearance and whatnot, and just think, hey, I've got unlimited power, I've got unlimited resources, and I've got a completely undetectable form of mind control that I can use remotely on world leaders. Boom! We're set, baby. At least that's what I'd do if I was a criminal sociopath with more money and power than God.
I think once you get over the hurdle of saying, okay, yeah, I believe that this kind of ability actually works, then you get probably into the realm of, oh, maybe I don't really want too many people to know that this works for exactly the kinds of reasons you're talking about.
I have this great concern that this might be a possibility because there's no defense against it. It reminds me of the one of the opening scenes in the first X-Men film where the people actually were talking about how there are mutants out there that are so powerful that they can enter our minds and control our thoughts, taking away our God-given free will. And there's been many scenes in that series of movies exploring the potential of psychic abilities to freeze people, read their minds, control them. And I was just wondering how much of that is based on reality and how much of it is just totally fictionalized.
I think that, you know, I was once walking down the street with Ingo, and I forget what we were talking about, and he said something like, you know, I think that people really hate the idea, they cannot stand the idea that you could actually read their mind. I said, yeah, I know that. And it's true if you think about it. Now, I have many friends who they can read my mind. I can read their minds. Now, all the time, no. But you can do it enough, especially if you put your intention there, that you can sort of read people. And you can, depending on your abilities, you may have, you may be able to astral travel. You may be able to show up. You know, I certainly have had friends who have been able to check in. For example, when I was in college, I was friendly with, I had two friends. They were brother and a sister. Their mother, and I didn't realize this at the time, was she was one of the top alien channelers in the world. She was quite famous. I had no idea. But her kids were these incredibly, you know, straight-laced, down-to-earth, no-nonsense, like scary. They went into computers and journalism and became very, they did very well in their fields. But they would tell me stuff like, well, yeah, you know, mom was channeling some alien the other day, and within 17 seconds, she put on 40 pounds and popped all the buttons on her shirt, and her belt dropped off, and, you know, she had no control over it. That took her years to lose the weight. Or they told me, yeah, mom, she was doing some astral traveling last night, just checking up on us, making sure that we weren't staying out too late and partying. And a third, a friend, somebody that we all knew, would tell me, yeah, I smelled a particular fragrance, which was her perfume fragrance, as she went through my room. She was a roommate of one of the sister. And, you know, then the mother would tell the kids what she saw them doing the previous night so she could verify it. So you can read people that way. Actually, I had an interesting thing too. I was told by a friend of mine, this was, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I was under anesthesia. I was having a procedure done. And while that was happening, I apparently showed up in her room. And she lives all the way across the country, over on the West Coast. And I went off about all kinds of stuff. I was apparently complaining about something to do with, something I had written, and I seemed to be pulling reams of paper off of this printing press, and I'm angry and complaining. I have my hands on my hips. And then I was, I think I was swearing in French. I do speak French. She didn't know any of this stuff. Turns out, as I told her, that right before I went in for that procedure, I had had to sign my contract with my publisher, who said, you have, you know, whatever it was, 90 days to put this thing together. So, you know, whether you're traveling to them or they're traveling to you, or whether it's all being done through the mind, whether you're visiting remotely, whether you're out of body, everybody's still gathering information. And so we need to give up the idea that we are, you know, these independent little beings with our private little thoughts. That just isn't the case.
Well, is astral traveling a lot less intrusive than normal traveling? I mean, is there some kind of like a cosmic TSA agent that will mess with your day if you're not doing it right?
No, nobody's going to mess with you. Not as far as I know. I mean, maybe there is, but not as far as I know.
So there's no like demons or other dimensional beings or something like that are just going to like, I don't know, latch onto you like in some dark sci-fi movie and suck your brain juices out of your astral skull.
You know, one of the most famous people in the paranormal field. His name was Hans Holzer, and he passed away a few years ago. But I had a chance to go and talk to him. I visited him at his apartment, interviewed him. And I think I asked him at that point, I said, you know, is it true with mediums that, you know, when they leave their bodies and they're stepping aside, as they say, so that another being, whatever that being is, can channel through their physical body? I said, I've heard that, you know, they're attached by a silver cord. And if the silver cord breaks, well, then, oops, you know, you lost your body forever, for eternity. And he started laughing. He said, no, there's no such thing as a silver cord. And no, you don't have to worry about that. Now, I've heard people say otherwise. So my theory is, well, let's be conservative. You know, if you got a good thing going, don't mess with it. So that's why I'm, I don't do serious deep trance channeling. For that reason.
Too risky.
I think it's risky because I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. And frankly, I don't want to find out.
You've not seen have you gone through reports, evidence, anecdotes, things of that nature where people have been psychically attacked? I've did a episode on psychopaths one time. And one of the stories that the researcher brought out was about a psychopath that was in prison that got visited by a little boy who was doing a little bit of a study for school or whatever. And then that little boy apparently got raped or something like that in his room, in his mind. And it was that psychopath doing it or apparently or something. There's some kind of astral projection or power base that they're capable of sending out on the wavelength and actually bringing it down into their victim somehow. Or at least that's what their theory was. I don't know if you've heard anything like that.
I don't know about that. One of my other main mentors, Nancy Orlin Weber, is a psychic detective. She's also a nurse. And at one time, she was a head nurse in a psychiatric hospital. So, I mean, she used to tell me all the time that there's psychotics can be extremely psychic. It doesn't mean it's the same thing, but a lot of psychotics, the problem is that they tend to be among the group of very vulnerable people. And by vulnerable, usually you're talking about, you know, young kids, teenagers especially, people who their health isn't good. They're depressed. They're a little bit, you know, schizophrenic, psychotic, that kind of thing. And they're just more prone to being psychically attacked. Now, whether those people are also going on the attack, I don't know anything about that. I just know from the reverse. So they need higher levels of protection, you know, than your average person does.
What do you mean by protection? How exactly can you protect yourself psychically against stuff? Just keeping healthy and not hanging around with douchebags, or?
Well, you see, you got it all figured out. Yeah, I mean, you keep yourself as healthy as you can. I mean, your psychic abilities definitely go down when you're not feeling well. You don't get into addictions. You don't get into, you know, drugs or alcohol. And if you're working, you never, ever, ever do any of that stuff because it just clouds up the ability. You keep yourself positive. What I tell my students all the time is tune into your, not just tune in, know your psychic or your spiritual allies. Because when you're wandering around in the spiritual world or the psychic world, you know, we're kind of stuck. A lot of us is stuck here in our physical bodies, in the physical three-dimensional world. So we're at somewhat of a disadvantage. So know who you're dealing with, at least, you know, the good guys, the guys on your side. Know who they are before you go walking around in the middle of, you know, some place that you don't really know.
Of course, that can be very difficult if you're a teenager to know good from bad. That's kind of what growing up is about. My very amazing, spectacular guest is Nancy Duterte, the conservative psychic. There we go.
The skeptical psychic.
The skeptical conservative psychic. All right. The skeptical conservative preserve psychic. All right. We will be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so if you want it to continue, please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and subscribe today. There's also a couple of products on there, the Blue Shield, protecting yourself from EMF and EMR, wireless radiation, 3G and Bluetooth. That's kind of stuff is nasty. By the way, if you're a Mac user, they automatically have the Bluetooth on. Automatically, and that stuff is nasty. So right up in the top right hand corner next to your clock or whatever, there's a little Bluetooth symbol. If you just click that with your mouse and you turn that Bluetooth off, you'll stop a rating adding your thingies. Yes, we'll be right back.
If you place a thing in the center of your life that lacks the power to nourish, it will eventually poison everything that you are and destroy you. As simple a thing as an idea or your perspective on yourself or the world. No one can be the source of your content. It lies within, in the center.
Only with mellow are you thinking of to slide through. Only with mellow are you thinking of to slide through.
Don't let nothing ride you.
If the sun on the moon should give way to die,
they would immediately go out.
One swallow don't make a summer, but tomorrow has to start somewhere.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Oh my god. I don't know what to say about New Zealand anymore. Honestly, it's in the middle of an election, so it doesn't really matter, because however bad the country is, it's just going to get worse, so there's very little point in describing its current state of affairs. My amazing, spectacular, again, somewhat magnanimous special guest is Nancy Duterte, the skeptical psychic, otherwise known as the conservative psychic. Well, she's not actually known as that. I just made that up, but yeah. So, Nancy.
Hummus.
What was that about? Wurzel Gummidge as hummus?
Don't go spreading rumors. Oh. Skeptical.
Yeah. Well, hence, it wasn't a rumor, because I just admitted right after saying it that I just made it up. And, yeah, does it mean it's spread if it's only said just to the same person right there and then is corrected directly afterwards? I'm not sure. Rumors are a dodgy thing.
Depends on your listenership.
It does. I have a pretty discerning listenership. which means that if I say anything that offends them, they stop listening to me forever, which is good, because I don't like those kind of people listening to me, because they're kind of too reactionary. You know. In fact, that's another thing I'd like to talk to you about, just in a general kind of way, is people's reactions, right? And I'm sure that there must be these entirely negative and cynical people out there who will dismiss everything that you're saying, even though even if you've produced mountains of evidence, it doesn't matter to them. It's just outside of their realm of possibility, and so therefore it can't be possibly existing.
Right. Well, they used to bother me, and I am no longer disturbed by those people, because now I just feel sorry for them, because they haven't taken the journey. They haven't bothered to explore. They are they just have these prefab ideas that are really simple for them, so that they can live their lives and not be concerned about things that are a little bit too complicated for them. And that's fine. You know, they should do that. But what I have discovered is that usually, you know, even if, you know, I get some rolling eyeballs or people saying, almost every single person that I talk to about this kind of stuff will at some point pull me aside and tell me their private story. So everybody's got a story. Everybody seems to be lacking in the courage to talk about these kinds of things. That's all right. They'll get there. They'll figure it out, you know. So I just don't worry about them.
Well, it's funny you should mention that about courage to say it, because that was actually something like my Facebook status today. There was a big meeting in Auckland, New Zealand, where Julian Assange and Edward Snowden attended a town hall meeting via video conferencing software with Kim.com, talking about the state surveillance, spying, and all of that kind of jazz. I presume you've heard about the New World Order, the global conspiracy of banking scumbags to like take over everything. And it's a pretty self-evident if you look at the evidence and the things that these bankers themselves even admit that they're trying to do. And one thing frustrated me during the conference is that Assange, Snowden, Kim.com, the other commentators that were there, they all perfectly described the New World Order and the intelligence apparatus and all of this kind of stuff that they're using to try and enslave everybody. And they described everything perfectly the exact same way I would, except they very, very carefully avoided saying that full picture truth, that world government, that New World Order, that scumbaggery element or psychopathy or anything of that nature. And it frustrated me, Nancy, because...
You mean they refuse to just qualify it that way, or to characterize it like that?
Well, it's more like if you're describing a car without saying that it's a car. Like if you describe steering wheel and wheels and an engine and an exhaust and doors and a roof and everything, and then people say, you're describing a car, and you go, no, I'm not. That kind of thing.
Right, okay.
And it was really frustrating to me because myself and a number of colleagues in New Zealand who are far more knowledgeable than I, who have written books, who have exposed copious quantities of scumbaggery, have been saying everything that these guys said in this town hall and more, and have been doing so for years. And I was quite frustrated. I wrote a bit of a scathing piece about that, but also, you know, giving big ups to thank you for coming out and saying a little bit of the truth or whatever you could. But somebody actually commented, and he argued that speaking the full truth gets people put off, you know, and that I should probably turn it down a bit tone it down a bit if I want people to listen to me.
It's a little bit late.
Well, the thing is, I agree with that sentiment that if you don't tell people the truth, they're more likely to listen to you. However, I argue that if no one has the balls to say the whole truth, it doesn't matter how long you dance around the edges, no one will ever be comfortable enough to accept it. And nobody else will be encouraged or inspired by the courage it takes to tell it to a room full of cowards too afraid to listen.
I understand that. But the thing is, you never know, particularly with those two. I mean, really with those two, you have no idea what kinds of pressures they're under. I mean, they obviously took very unique and very, very courageous pathways to do what they both did. But, you know, maybe they've had to jam on the brakes for reasons that, you know, we'll never know. In which case, it just means that somebody else has to pick up the mantle and you know, run with whatever the larger picture is to paint that picture for people. But you're right. I mean, I think there's a problem overall in this world, you know. We're lacking leadership, and we're lacking people who have the courage to take a position. Because we all know, taking a position, I mean, you just get shot from every direction. I mean, people just go for you. But that's what it takes. So
it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it is. But that's, we need that. And I would say also that, you know, the world has gotten so unbelievably complex, and everything is so, you know, interrelated. And with the U.S., certainly, I mean, all the issues that are going on in the Middle East right now, here we are in this strangely weird and uncomfortable position of having to now, you know, negotiate with people that we were, you know, screaming at and threatening, you know, a year ago, or, you know, invading or not invading, or, you know, now today I'm your ally, tomorrow I'm not, or maybe we'll switch around, or maybe I'll take one of your allies or you take one of mine. It's just craziness. So it's very hard for anybody to really want to take a position, you know, because you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring.
I think this is part of a deliberate agenda to make people switch off, because if you see two people going, you're a scumbag, no, 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 you're a scumbag, the person just switches off because you can't tell who's actually a scumbag.
I think that's the best defense is always to, you know, best defense is good offense.
Best defense is a good offense.
Well, there you go.
Well, my friend Jonathan Eisenman told me that if you're a Nazi, the best thing to accuse your opponents of is being Nazis.
Oh yeah, of course. No, I I know that quite well.
And then the other part is charlatans. Do you think that within your kind of field of research that there are actually people who deliberately mislead and deceive others for their own self-aggrandizement, accumulation of power, resources, that kind of thing?
I'm sure there are. I have absolutely no doubt, because you find those people in any field that you go into. But I think more people go into it with desires to help other people, but they get caught up in this sort of performance anxiety of, well, you know, I've said that I have these special powers, and I've got somebody out there who is looking for me to, you know, perform these special powers like right now. And if I don't, they're going to think that either that I'm not what I say I am, or that I'm not very powerful. So people get stuck in a bind.
It could be, actually, you don't know how these powers actually work, son.
Well, yeah, I mean, nobody...
I mean, my wife, for example, she just went to take her van to get its fuel pump fixed, and then the oil pump broke a couple of weeks after, you know, like the two separate pieces of a car, and she still thinks that the people at the garage deliberately sabotaged her car. It's like, baby, you don't know how the machine works, okay? Neither do I. And unfortunately, when you're dealing with somebody, your suspicions, if they're not based on evidence or perhaps some kind of knowledge in the area with which to verify those suspicions, you're kind of taking a stab in the dark, and you might stab somebody you love.
Well, she's got a good theory. I mean, you got to give her that. It's a good theory. It's not a correct theory, but... You know, she's working on it.
Oh yeah, we'll see how the documents declassified come out. You know.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the government, we know that there's remote viewing programs and things like that, and we talked about weaponization of the psychic field. I wonder, is there any kind of attempts to, I don't know, ensure a distrust? Because basically I found, like, let's say in movies, for instance, sci-fi movies in particular, they'll put out a piece of technology or a piece of storyline or dialogue or something of that nature which relates very much to what's going on today. For example, the movie Surrogates was about these artificial robots that everybody was plugged into, and those robots would actually be them, basically. They'd be walking around. They'd just be at home in a machine, and their robot would live their life for them, and they'd be in full control of it the whole time. And then about less than a year later, it comes out in the news that the US military has developed those exact robots. And I'm just wondering what kind of film references and things of that nature you could probably point to that have some basis in reality in terms of psychic studies.
You know, first of all, I didn't see Surrogate, so I don't know what that was, you know.
It's just an example. It happens all the time in all sorts of movies.
Yeah, I'm probably the wrong person because I don't see that many movies. The last one that I can really remember that sticks out in my head was the one that they clearly did that was sort of loosely based on the whole remote viewing program, which is Men Who Stare at Goats.
I've seen that one, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I know a lot of the characters who were loosely, portrayed in that movie. But, you know, that kind of stuff, yeah, I mean, there's people, I would say that they're probably doing that plus way more. I mean, they're not really showing, you know, anywhere near the capacity of what people are doing. But there, I think there is a, you know, from the time that we have movies to the time that things are happening in our world, I think they're really interesting correlations. And I don't know whether it's because you've got movie producers who were sort of being given an inside track that, like, for example, Steven Spielberg in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you know, he was allegedly given a whole stack of documents off of an Air Force base so that he could come up with the concepts that he did, and they were extremely accurate. And I'm sure that happens in a lot of different fields.
And in terms of, let's say, the government or the alleged New World Order, if you want to call it that, would they have an agenda to suppress knowledge of psychic abilities and perhaps because it would make it easier to control people if they didn't know about this realm?
You know, you got me in a very hypothetical realm, but let's say hypothetically you had a New World Order that was somehow in alliance with certain otherworldly entities that already had a lot of those capabilities, then you might want to use those capabilities. You might want to suppress those capabilities in others. I don't know.
You know, I always see human potential as a threat to tyranny, right? Because human potential is unlimited, and the thing about tyranny is that doesn't have any limits either. There's no, I mean, can you name me, like, what's the pinnacle? What's the worst possible thing you could anybody could ever do? Something that would actually make them the worst human being on earth? What act? And the answer is whatever's worse than the last person, because there's no upper limit to it. Just like.
Upper level to evil, yeah.
And I was just wondering, though, is that there's an upper level to or lower level of goodness in people, and this whole psychic phenomenon, it kind of, I'm starting to wonder what sort of element to it is actually more spiritual. If we're not just talking about the universe in and of itself. I mean, are they really gods or angels that are simply outside of the 3D realms and people's ability to perceive them that can be reached out to or can possibly be in the background subtly influencing people, whispers in the ears or giving you a sensation, a little bit of courage at the right moment, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, all of the above. That's my experience over the last, couple of decades, which is, yeah, absolutely. And the more, by the way, that I'm getting into this whole UFO field, I used to think it was, a bunch of fanatics who were sort of saying, well, the ETs are the equivalent of angels and devils. And, of course, they got all the fundamentalists and different religions all upset. Because they, and they were saying, well, these are a bunch of kooks who were saying that. Well, the more you look into the characteristics of people who have had contact or abductions with these different types of entities and the way in which they show up, the similarities are unbelievable. Right down to, and I'll just give you a couple of examples. I mean, right down to... a lot of the kinder entities or the more, what I would call higher, more spiritually advanced, sending information through light and primarily, they're surrounded in white light. Well, that sounds kind of familiar. And they do seem to fly and they do engage in things, spontaneous healing of humans. And then you have other types of entities, for example, that are known for pretty nasty sounding abductions where people do experience huge amounts of pain, apparently. And a lot of those entities have, I think it's absolutely ironic. I mean, they have a smell. And I can tell you the first time I ever get contacted by somebody, this was an abductee who was looking for help because nobody would listen to him, couldn't get anything in the more conservative worlds, and he was checking around the UFO worlds. Nobody could help him, so he got in touch with me. And, I saw photos of him. He's a really big, muscular guy. Apparently not, I don't think he was afraid of too many things, but these beings that would come into his bedroom at night, he was absolutely terrified of because they would, take him, they would abduct him. And he had no control the way a lot of them don't. They are paralyzed through some type of, I don't know whether it's through a frequency vibration or through a mental vibration. Maybe it's the same thing.
A kind of a force field? Or?
Yeah. Yeah. And people report the only thing they can move is their eyeballs. That's it. And they're absolutely terrified, and they're floated out through windows, through walls. I mean, I was just having dinner a couple weeks ago with a woman who I remember her story. She was floated out out of her 12-story apartment in New York City when I was living there. And I said to myself, well, that's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. Well, she's got more than 100 witnesses. And finally, and I remember when this happened too, one of them happened to be the former Secretary General of the UN. And his, I think his chauffeur and his one of his attachés. So crazy stuff happens. But my point is, this fellow that I was talking to, he said, yeah, and these things that are so evil looking, they have a smell. I said, what's the smell? Oh, they smell, I don't know, kind of like rotten eggs. Oh, kind of like sulfuric. Well, if you go back to the traditional concept of hell and the devils, you got the smell of sulfur.
Brimstone.
Yeah. So it wouldn't surprise me that a lot of our, the angels and demons origins within our religions may come from these kinds of entities. That wouldn't surprise me.
What if most of our religions are actually based on aliens and they just tell people, oh, it's God? Yeah. And that kind of thing.
Sure. I mean, you can easily, once you get into this stuff and you start seeing the facts, you can easily say, yeah, that's kind of logical, actually. Whether I prefer, I don't know whether it's a preference or whether it's my feeling about the spirituality, my sense is you don't reach the level of God. You might get close, but it's not God. And for me, I think, you know, God is something closer in equivalence to the consciousness of, you know, the all of our universe. So that these entities are still, a lot of them are somewhat physical with, you know, three-dimensional or interdimensional. And, but that doesn't rise to the level of what I consider God. That's a little different.
Well, God's all powerful, all knowing, all this, all that. And as far as I know, no humans ever achieved that. I mean, not yet.
But I know you're working on it, Vinny.
Well, no, I'm not working on it. I've decided that trying to achieve godly status is something I'll never achieve. And I'm quite happy about that because it's a lot of responsibility being God. And concept that I've found is that all it is about striving to your personal image of your higher self. You know, like, for example, my God is somebody who looks kind of like me, sounds kind of like me, except they're way better and they're perfect in every way. Flawless, something that I could never possibly hope to achieve. And it is my belief that if you strive towards the impossible, knowing that you'll never achieve it, just because it is your higher self, just because it's amazing in and of itself, that's the way to live your life.
Absolutely, I agree with you. I mean, with one small exception, I would just say your higher self, yeah, that is a piece of God, you know, but there's many, 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 many other parts. Other than that, I agree with you.
See, sometimes people, if you want to get in touch with their higher self, just smoke weed, you know, it works.
I don't know that that works.
Oh, no, sorry, that's getting yourself higher. I forgot, there's a difference. We've got only a couple of minutes left in the broadcast with you here today, Nancy. I'd love it if you'd be able to, I don't know, if you've got any pearls of wisdom or websites or products and things of that nature that you want to throw out there, go for your life.
Let's see. Well, I mean, if anybody wants to get in touch with me, they always can on my website, which is theskepticalpsychic.com. In terms of what I've been doing recently, no. I mean, I think this Experiencers Speak 2014, the UFO conference for contactees and abductees and, you know, anybody who's been in touch with the alien world, they should be coming out with DVDs, I think, of the different presenters' speeches. So, you know, if anybody's interested, they could probably do it that way and listen to my speech on exolinguistics. Or how to speak to an alien. Other than that, no, I'm working on, I have several things that I'm working on, but nothing concrete other than I still have got my book, Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know, that's out there and available on Amazon, a bunch of other places. That's about it.
Well, thank you very much for your time. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in. I hope you've actually enjoyed this little interview with Nancy here, because she's one of the most fantastic women I know. And I know a lot of fantastic women, really.
You're so nice.
Yeah.
See, now you made my day.
Yeah, I'm good like that. And ladies and gentlemen, perhaps you could make my day, considering my name's Eastwood, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I know him.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Maybe you could introduce me, because I've always wanted to say, hello, Mr. Eastwood. And like, hello, Mr. Eastwood.
He's a very kind person. He really is.
Well, he would be, you know. I mean, look, if you're going to blow people away for the bulk of the 70s and the movies, you must be a really awesome dude. Okay. Go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, ladies and gentlemen, and donate today. And we also would love you to go to that KiwiBank account if you happen to be in New Zealand. You do realize that this is kind of like the only actual New Zealand alternative media that isn't like, I don't know, totally biased towards nonsense and wankery. I mean, oh my God! Oh my God, ladies and gentlemen. Your choices in New Zealand are very, very slim. So I'm going to make sure, personally, to take personal responsibility to ensure that there is a new alternative media rising out of New Zealand. not entirely like some kind of a scary alien spaceship out of a deep underground military base that's classified. We'll be right back. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. It's just a really, really nice little jewel in the South Pacific, which is a strategic nuclear sub outlet, and we're dredging our harbours to allow for aircraft nuclear power carriers as well. This is going to be good. It's going to be good. You can't go wrong when you've got nuclear domination in your waters. My very amazing, spectacular, somewhat ridiculously fabulous guest is Joel McDermott. Joel, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I've never had an introduction like that before.
I know. Somebody told me that everybody introduces themselves as my very special guest. So I figured, you know, why don't we just introduce some vocabulary into it? It's just as meaningless, but it sounds way, way better.
Gotcha. I may come back. I like that.
I think it is a good idea. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is you do, for those who are unfamiliar?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, a friend of mine, a mutual friend of ours, recommended this a show for me, basically because I work for a Christian ministry, and that may sound odd maybe to a lot of your guests, I'm not sure, but I work for a Christian ministry in the United States called American Vision. And I work a lot in the realm of politics, economics, somewhat foreign policy, really what we would say giving biblical ideas, biblical principles behind social policy. And in the past, that's largely been done by leftists. And it wasn't until the middle of last century that a group of guys began to look over scripture, look at actually some of Old Testament law and some other principles, and say, wait a minute, this is not at all what it teaches. Why should the leftists have the death grip on the Bible here? And they began to teach some of those principles themselves and found out, what do you know, there's actually free market principle here. There's actually a very limited role for government. There's actually a very limited role for foreign policy. There's actually a strong indictment against war and things of that nature. There's a very strong indictment against a standing army. And so they began to write and codify some of these things, and I'm kind of the second to third generation of that movement, and I've been writing about the past 5 to 6 years in this genre, and I found out that I have a lot of overlap with a lot of libertarians and actually quite a bit with some anarchists, or if you would say anarcho-capitalists, in that realm as well. So a lot of criticism of big government, of statism, of everything that goes along with that, and it's led to a lot of interesting relationships, if you will, and here we are today.
What got you into this yourself, personally? How'd you get involved?
Oh, well, that's a long, long story. I have...
We have time, and I love long stories.
It's actually... I'm trying to think where to start. You know, there's always the personal testimony, and then there's the personal testimony that's relevant. So I'm trying to think of where to parse that out. But
I'd say give us both, and that way the listeners can work it out for themselves.
Works for me. Well, I was raised in probably what you consider a typical mainstream American home. Nominal Christian, church on Sundays, but not a whole lot of ideology from any perspective, really. It was public schooling. It was, you know, day-to-day, watch TV, get your news from the 6 o'clock news type stuff. And it wasn't until I was about 19, I suppose, I was about 17 when my mom divorced for the second time, which is also becoming more mainstream American and certainly modern. And that kind of left me on my own. I left the family situation and just kind of went off, did my own thing. Met some friends who were going to a different type of church, which was Pentecostal. And I started going to church with them when I was about 19. And my friend and I were both members of a rock and roll band. I was a guitarist and he was a singer. And when he decided to get back in church, he decided to take his talents. He was also a drummer and play for the church band. So he invited me. And the next thing I know, I was driving church buses and playing for the church band too. And it was about that time, around 19, 20 years old, that I got serious about studying scripture. And it was one day I remember making a conscious decision. I said, if I'm going to do this Christian thing, I'm going to sit down and do it right. And so I just cracked open the Bible and started reading. And that was 20 years ago almost, and has been a constant study ever since, and a lot of changes, a lot of decisions and things of that nature along the way. But that friend of mine and me are still very close friends today, although we live quite a ways apart. And it was through my studies that I eventually left the Pentecostal church and what some Christians would consider the pure fundamentalist world, and went into the Reformed camp, which is smaller but much older. And that's where I began my what I would consider my serious studies, and really began to get into scholarship. And around the year 2000, I guess it was 2004, when I finally got to seminary, I'd finished a bachelor's degree in philosophy and rhetoric in the state of Arkansas, and in the U.S. And then went to seminary for 3 years in Pennsylvania, got a Master of Divinity degree. And after that, I got a job with the ministry I currently work for. And during the same time, I completed a doctorate degree from Pretoria in South Africa. And that actually is a great program because they allow you to do it by distance. You and I are sitting here talking by Skype, and I actually did my oral defense of my dissertation by Skype with video. It was pretty interesting. But anyway, so along those lines, and after many years of study, I am where I am today. And I kind of fell in with this group of guys that are doing social theory from a biblical perspective. And it turns out our studies lead us into a pretty radical free market perspective. And so that's the stuff I write. I challenge not only the left, but the conservative party in the United States. I'm oftentimes getting pelted with tomatoes, or figuratively speaking, from Republicans and conservatives because I criticize their guys. But it's due. It's absolutely due. They're just as big a statists as the left is in many cases, in most cases. And that's where I've ended up today. And I write on broad range of topics, everything from pure biblical studies, theology, end times doctrines, which is the Christian doctrine of eschatology. That's huge. And a lot of people don't realize that, but that's absolutely huge, especially in the United States. A huge force behind the statist push, especially in foreign policy and support for it, the modern state of Israel. So we write a lot about that. But again, like I said, we deal with social theory and social policy, do a lot of work on law, the nature of law, and things of that nature. I write on court cases. I published a book last year called Restoring America, One County at a Time. The basic principle in it is the concept of decentralization of power. And that book covers 10 broad topics: education, welfare, local government, state government, markets, courts, defense. I forget all the other ones off the top of my head, but there were 10 topics that I covered in that, all from a biblical perspective, all what maybe many of your listeners would recognize as a radical free market libertarian perspective, but from my background, it's a biblical perspective. And so that overlap, like I said, has created a tremendous amount of interesting relationships from all the way from friends of mine I have in the Republican Party here in the state of Georgia in the U.S., to libertarians and anarchists and all kinds of guys, even atheists, who, you know, they and I would be on, you know, on fighting terms in a different context. But here we are holding a considerable amount of common ground in social theory.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's on the points you agree you should come together and collaborate, and those that you disagree, you can kind of leave those arguments for another time. Probably it would be good to leave it for a time when we're not currently under the threat of domination by criminal, ruthless, sociopathic scum.
Absolutely, and I think that's where it comes down to. A lot of what happens is, from a biblical perspective, is absolutely criminal. Statism is criminal. And from, you know, one of the basic passages we always teach on, and I'm not sure what your background in Christianity or the Bible is, but one of the basic passages we always come back to is in the book of 1 Samuel. This was fairly early in Israel's history, and she was never intended to have a monarchy. She was never intended to have a ruler of that nature, an executive power, if you will, and certainly not a legislature. And at this point in Israel's history, people began to lose faith in the system of government they were given, which was basically self-government under God. And they came to Samuel, who was their prophet and kind of their prophetic leader, and said, "We want a king like all the other nations around us have." Are you familiar with this passage at all?
No, I haven't actually read the Bible, but I'm receptive.
Good. Oh, well, you'll find this interesting then. So they come to Samuel and they say, "We want a king like all the other nations around us have." Well, here, according to the biblical narrative, God's given these people the best form of government that can be given. It's self-government under God. Nobody's telling you what to do. You don't have rulers regulating every aspect of your life. As you said earlier, the criminal junta or whatever. And yet they want to be like these other nations. What do the other nations have? They had great kings, great leaders, usually men of great physical stature, who were representative military rulers. They were representative of conquest. And these people who are supposed to be living in peace and prosperity and under God's law are saying, "Hey, wait a minute, we want to be like these other nations who have this symbol of national greatness by which they go out into battle and conquer other nations." And the text says that Samuel was infuriated about this. Why would the people depart from the good life to go fight the thug life, to go live the thug life? And so he prays to God, and God says to him, you can give them what they want, and they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. God says this is a rejection of him. Statism is a rejection of God. That's what he says. And he tells Samuel to give them what they ask for. You know, it reminds me of H.L. Mencken's quote that democracy is that form of government in which the people get what they ask for, good and hard. And it was kind of that on display in ancient Israel. But God says, you give them what they ask for, but tell them what it's really going to be like. And in this passage in the eighth chapter of 1 Samuel, he says, "Here's the manner of the king that will come. He's going to take your sons and conscript them for military service. He's going to take your daughters and your sons and conscript them for state service, compulsory national service. He's going to take a tenth of your income," which, by the way, wouldn't we love to return to that level of tyranny from modern times? "He's going to take a tenth of your fields and your crops. He's going to take your property." And he goes through this long list of tyrannies that this king was going to impose upon them. And when they thought that they were achieving national greatness through having some great military leader, they were actually inviting upon themselves tyranny in the form of statism. And they get it. They get who was known in the Bible as King Saul. And, of course, we could go on and teach history from there for a long perspective. What happens in Israel? Well, it's basically national decline, because it's one tyranny after another, and it's not until King David comes along that you get some restoration of freedom. Even then, it's not entirely restored. And so what you have is a people who have freedom in their hands, and they throw it away because they think something greater is before them, and the something greater is always military conquest. And that was absolutely forbidden according to God's law. It was not only not stated, it was absolutely forbidden. Now, there were laws that God provided for them in Deuteronomy 17 on the day that they ever did decide they wanted a king. And he says, if you do have a king, he may not multiply horses, which is an offensive military weapon. In other words, you can't have a standing army. He may not multiply gold and silver. In other words, he couldn't have a large treasury. And he could not multiply wives, which for royalty in those days was a means of forming international alliances. And actually, that existed clear up into the Middle Ages, probably even to today. And so you had all these restrictions upon an executive if they needed, if they wanted to have one. And yet when they get one, he just kind of blows all those laws out of the water and the state takes over. And the people are subjected to tyranny. And the history of Israel goes downhill from there until somewhat, 400 years later or so, they're in the Babylonian captivity. So, you know, that's a lot of history from the Bible in a nutshell. But the point is that you have this basic doctrine of self-government under God. It's attainable. You can have it. All you got to do is keep the right principles in place, love your neighbor as yourself, et cetera, et cetera. But we're not satisfied with that. And in not being satisfied with that, the population is the one that demands the tyrannies that we get. And once the tyrannies are in place, what do? They just grow, they breed, they propagandize, they use the very means by which they were established to grow themselves. And the next thing you know, you have Federal Reserve systems, you have fractional reserve banking, you have unlimited means of funding these tyrannies, which also is directly against biblical law. Not only were the governments forbidden to have a large treasury, but they were forbidden to dilute the money supply. They were forbidden to use, in biblical terms, false weights and measures. You shall have one weight and one measure in your bag. That pertains to all conducting of business, and it means you should have one standard of payment, and everything should be honest. You should have, as I would put it, honest money. Well, the moment the government begins inflating the money supply or diluting the money supply and the banks are involved and all that kind of stuff, what are you doing? You're literally robbing from the public through this means. You're robbing from future generations in the amount of their wealth and using that to fund the immediate causes of the state and the state's cronies.
Well, the way the state would look at that is we're going to kill most of the future generations, so technically we're not robbing from them.
Well, I mean, that comes right down to it too, doesn't it? You know, what's a little bit of theft if you're going to add murder on top of it? I mean,
when you kill one, what was it Stalin said? When you kill one, it is a statistic. Oh, what was it? It's a tragedy. But when you kill 10 million, it is a statistic.
It's a statistic, and you get the black book of communism out of it. Yeah, no, it's true, and whether that's direct conspiracy or whatever, it doesn't matter. That's the way things go, and it's the way things went.
Conspiracy is like human history in a nutshell. It's nothing but conspiracy after conspiracy after conspiracy. It'll get up, it'll get bad. It's kind of like a virus. You know how, I don't know if you've seen the very microscopic pictures of viruses, but they look like a rocket ship. And I was starting, yes, to think about the fractal universe theory, how everything's just kind of like a smaller version of something else. And I thought about, what if humans were in a rocket ship and then we went to a planet, and then we got out of the rocket ship, started building up our civilization, and then infect the planet, totally balls it up, and then jump in our rocket ship and go into another one and infect that. And then you have a look at how a cell works, and that's exactly how, the exact same thing. It comes in, pops into a cell, injects itself, corrupts the cell, destroys it, and then moves on to another area.
Well, I totally agree. And I would say statism and those who are part of it, are part of the virus. And, of course, that was the theme of the Matrix, right? But does it have to be that way is the bottom line. It seems like even those few of us who say, no, it doesn't have to be that way, are up against the billions who either don't care or are completely oblivious to the issue. And then you have the few on the other side who say, you know, absolutely, we'll do this and we'll get away with it and you can't stop us.
Do you think we actually need contrast in order to define who it is we are and what right is versus wrong?
I don't see how you would avoid it as right and wrong. If there's no contrast, there's no difference.
I was just thinking about that as well, because it's almost as if you need a tyranny in order for people to value freedom, and you need freedom in order for people to want tyranny. Isn't that strange? It's like a weird two-headed snake that's eating itself from both directions.
Well, yeah, I see what you're saying. No doubt. I mean, we get lulled to sleep over time. One of the great things about studying the Bible is that, I mean, here's a book, and by the way, there's a lot of difficult stuff in the Bible. I understand that, but here's a book that's been written covering a period of history over 6,000 years, roughly, depending on how you look at it. We'll say 6,000 years, okay? The thing you've just said is captured in Scripture. It's captured with Noah's generation. It's captured later with the next generation. It's captured in the generation of Babel after that. It's captured in Abraham's generation. It's captured after that in Moses in Egypt. It's captured after that with Samuel and Saul. It's captured after that over and over and over, all through Scripture. You see the same story over and over and over, that there is an ideal there that people could have if they would just want it, if they would just understand it, see it, and reach out and grab it. And yet they don't. They reach out for power. They reach out for lust. They reach out for tyranny over other people, usually involves tyrannizing themselves in the process. And why is that? Well, what you see are this pattern you're just talking about, you know, but along with that comes forms of judgment that set things back to right. There are discontinuities in history just as much as there are patterns in history. And I'm not sitting here saying we can predict these by any means, but that's the contrast you're talking about. We get into periods of history in which you can't see. We live in a very short-term environment. We live in a very limited scope, if you will, and we tend to draw our values and our beliefs about the future and whatnot from our immediate experience. And that is, we just have to back up and say that's extremely limited. I mean, I've never lived in a world where there wasn't Social Security. I don't know what you guys call that in New Zealand, but it's just status tyranny. It's a welfire state.
Yeah, we just call it social welfare or
social welfare. I've never lived in a time when there wasn't public schooling, and that wasn't considered the norm by 99% of the people.
Yeah,
but if you go back in my country's history before 1830, there were no government schools. There were none. People homeschooled, or they private schooled, or they had private tutors. There was not this vast machinery of dumbing people down into these little automatons for the state. And so my scope is very limited, and I have to step back and review the history over decades and centuries before I start to get a picture that, hey, man, there's something better out there. And when you come to biblical history, you get that even on a much grander scale, because you get the story of the Exodus. You get the stories of David, who's running from a state that's trying to kill him, even to the point he has to go hide in a cave in fear for his life. And yet God turns that situation around and eventually puts him on the throne. And he doesn't do a whole lot better than his predecessor did, but he does better. So if we back up and say, look at the long scope here. Yeah, there are these patterns, but they're all compressed within short times. And there are periods of relief in here in which you can see that there are advances made. You know, as bad a tyranny as the United States has turned into internationally, you know, has there ever been a form of government as, well, I'm not going to say as great. I'm not one of those kind of Americans. But was there ever a paralleled experience to the American Revolution prior to that? Well, maybe one place, not many.
Just after it, there was Haiti. Haiti was the second country in the world to become a republic and to overthrow their slave masters.
Okay. And then once America did it, you saw versions of it somewhat in other places. And so this represents an advance in history that had not been there before. And I'm a believer in advance in history over long periods of time. And I think that's what Scripture teaches. And I think it teaches us that this is a very slow process, very difficult process.
I believe in the cover-up of history in order to conceal scumbaggery.
Well, there's a lot of that, too. It depends on who's writing it, right?
It's like, what was it in the start of the film, Braveheart? History is written by those who have hanged heroes.
Joel, that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
One of the great things about a lot of the biblical history is that it presents its heroes, warts and all, to use Cromwell's phrase. You'll have a David who's this great national leader who brings a great government into play, but you'll also find out that behind the scenes, he committed all these gruesome acts, and he was not the kind of guy you would invite to the dinner party. So, you know, it shows you the guys in their worst light possible, so that you don't get this impression that here are guys just writing the history to reinvent themselves or whatever.
So it wasn't written by PR people, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and there's probably some of that here and there,
yeah.
Depending on what side of things you would be on. But
Joel, we've come into break just now. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen, with Joel McDermott. Joel, do you have a website just quickly before we go?
Absolutely, AmericanVision.org.
AmericanVision.org. And
there you can access all my articles, our store, and everything else. So.
Okay, and just bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood isn't go ahead, make my news. And go ahead, make a donation or start up a regular automatic payment into the Kiwi Bank account, if you happen to be a Kiwi, or the PayPal options there. We also are sponsored by the High Tea Cafe, Blue Shield, and the Gourmet Soap Kitchen in Wagga Wagga. God damn, I love saying the word Wagga Wagga. This is like some kind of a really, really sexy frog, you know? Like he's trying to pick up a female frog or something. Wagga Wagga. That's really weird. We'll be right back.
Present is gone. Fantasy is a part of reality, and we take the brakes off. We're thinking clearly, yet not thinking at all. And this feels right. We stop trying to control things. Warm rush of chemicals through us. We're fluctuating. Is this brain damage? We forget all the pain and the hurt in life. We want to go somewhere else. We're not threatened by people anymore. All our insecurities have evaporated. We're in the clouds now. We're wide open. We're spacemen, orbiting the Earth. Yeah, the world looks beautiful from here, man. We're nympholeptics, desiring for the unobtainable. We risk sanity for moments of temporary enlightenment. So many ideas, so little memory. The last thought killed by anticipation of the next. We embrace an overwhelming feeling of love. We flow in unison. We're together. I wish this was real. We want a universal level of togetherness where we're comfortable with everyone. We're in rhythm, part of a movement to escape. We wave goodbye. Ultimately, we just want to be happy. Yeah.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is now the final segment with Joel McDermott. Would you be technically qualified as like some kind of a biblical scholar? Does that work?
Yeah, actually, I could be a professor at a university or a seminary if they would have me. That's the bigger part of the problem. I tend to be too radical for any of the mainstream guys, but anyway.
Is that by chance because you tell the truth and your opposition are basically just telling one of two different sets of lies and they don't like the fact that you putting them to shame?
Yeah, of course, that's my side of the story, right? I mean, you know.
There's three sides to every story. There's two sides of BS and one little kernely nugget of truth in the middle there, isn't it?
That's right. Three stories, three sides of the story, yours, mine, and the truth. So, yeah, I mean, I am credentialed to teach what I've studied. So, and really, I did my dissertation in the area of dogmatic history, so I could teach either Christian theology or history, early modern history, without much problem. But you know, in my research and writing into my ministry, I've covered a lot more ground. I've written a lot on American history. I just put out a small ebook on Teddy Roosevelt, who was, as I titled the book, the American fascist there. So I've covered a lot of ground in those areas. I could work at a university, no problem at all. I've published a couple of articles in peer-reviewed academic journals. So So I am, if you said, what do you do? I would say you could call me a Bible scholar, certainly. But, you know, I find more fulfillment in working this ministry, in dealing with the public more often, being able to reach out to lay people. And as you said, tell the truth that other people won't tell. And, you know, a lot of times it causes conflicts, hurt feelings. People have their, you know, their tidy little worldviews upturned, and that disturbs people. But I see that as part of the ministry, to be able to enter into somebody's life who's, you know, turned their worldview upside down and show them that what errors they've made and the danger that comes out of it, specifically in foreign policy and in law and things of that nature.
Have you found by not only ignoring that reality it's dangerous, but in being the person to expose that reality to somebody else, it puts you in danger? I saw a great Facebook picture that says, when you're right and the state is wrong, you're in trouble.
I haven't had much backlash from the state itself yet. I have had...
I wasn't referring specifically to the state giving you backlash. I'm talking about just more ordinary people who have lived their entire lives in a dream.
Yeah.
And you're violently waking them up from that dream, and they really don't like it. They want to go back to sleep.
Right. There is some of that. There's a lot of, you know, I don't take a lot of it seriously. I mean, I live in the United States, so I conceal carry 24/7. So I'm never too worried about something like that. But I've had a couple of guys get in the message or the comments at the end of the articles and whatnot, and just they talk real tough. But usually it's a 60-year-old guy who's a former Army vet who's probably disabled, not married, and he's probably lonely. He's got nothing else to do, sit at home and, you know, gripe on his computer. So I haven't had a serious problem with that yet. I'm not saying it couldn't happen by any means. I have had death threats that, you know, you always have to take those somewhat seriously. But no, I haven't had too much of that.
Nothing physically coming at you.
No, but I do get a considerable amount of backlash. The good side of it is that as our ministry grows and we persuade a considerable number of people, we tend to get just as much positive feedback as we do negative. And the negative tends to go away over time, because if they stick around arguing for very long, they can't prevail. And, you know, so I'm encouraged in that respect. As far as what feedback there is, I'm very encouraged. And it's a great thing. It's a great thing to be able to, you said a while ago, you know, why would they not welcome me in these universities or seminaries because I tell the truth and put them to shame? Well, some of that happens. Some of that certainly happens, but I think you're finding very slowly, a wider variety of guys who are waking up to the truth and realizing that the positions that have been held, specifically in what's been called historically dispensationalism, is just completely untenable. And anybody who you seriously tries to hold that position and maintain any facade of being a university professor just ends up looking like a total idiot at the end of the day. And so that's, especially since about the mid-80s and 90s, has slowly faded away, and we're seeing a phenomenon of attrition. The old guys that held that position are dying off or retiring. The new guys coming in are holding modified positions, and they may still be supporters of Israel, but they're nowhere near what was there the year before or the generation before. So there is progress. It's slow, but there is progress.
Mm. Well, so three topics that I find that are very, very dangerous to talk about on the radio. One's Israel, the other is race, and the other is sex. You know, it's just
In American culture, you say you never talk about politics, sex, or religion.
Yeah, yeah.
And I make a pretty good habit of talking about all three.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's through politics that a lot of these old ugly men continue to get sex.
That's absolutely true.
Because it's like Henry Kissinger said, "Power is the ultimate aphrodisiac." Did that sound pedophilic enough? I think. Let me see if I can do it worse. I'll just restrain myself for a moment there, because that's just going overboard.
We get the point.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I have a friend of a friend who had a guy that he had a friend that was a lobbyist in D.C. and he came back with a very similar assessment. He said, you know, if you can't handle their booze and you can't handle their prostitutes, then you don't need to be there. Because that's what makes everything run in D.C.
Somebody once said that politics is show business for ugly people.
Well, that's certainly true on the left. I guess maybe on the right, too. I don't know.
Yeah. Is there much certainly of a difference between left or right? Because it occurs to me that basically the left and right-wing parties of all of our Western nations now are merely status that dress up and share each other's policies and then go to sex orgies at Rothschild houses like an Eyes Wide Shut later on.
Yeah, I you know, you can never know exactly how much of that to trust, but it doesn't surprise me at all. After studying, I spent a good deal of time studying the occult traditions coming down from Giordano Bruno and a bunch of the others through the formation of the Freemasonic organizations and all of their connections and their influences in American history and continuing even into the churches, especially Baptist and Methodist churches in the United States, but also Presbyterian and Episcopal. It is widespread, and you know, you can get an idea that there is influence there and there is nonsense like that goes on. And in some places I look at certain signs and logos and I can see the influence through symbols. But you don't know exactly how far it goes, and those movies like that make you wonder, how bad is it? But, you know, when people are enslaved to systems like that, which is nothing but an enslavement to lust, they become very predictable and very controllable people. And so I don't attribute to them omniscience and omnipotence, if you will. And that's one of the areas where my hope is, because as a Christian, I look at Scripture and I see the doctrine of a God who's all-powerful, all-wise, and I see men who want to be that and who make every effort to be that God, but they're not Him. There's as far from Him as finite is from infinite. And yet they create institutions, they create doctrines, they use every trick in the book, every lie in the book, every murder and every dirty thing there is in the book to try to maintain that stance. Statism, that which is what statism is, by the way. What is statism? It's the attempt of man to pretend he's the divine, he's the God.
It's statinism.
Yeah, you can call it that. I mean, you've got philosophers like George Hegel who literally said that the state is the expression of the divinity on earth. It is the march of the divinity on earth. I mean, this is,
and which one of the divine servants got cast down to earth, though, I wonder?
If you want to call him divine, he's not natural by any means. But
yeah, well, technically he only killed like 17 people in the Bible, whereas God killed 3.5 million. But we're not going to split hairs here or something.
Well, and again, that's one of the classic arguments against biblical history. But what did you call them while ago? What did you call this state? I mean, I forget exactly what term you use, but it's a mafia. It's a professional mafia. And you have mobs and mobs of people who back that mafia enthusiastically, hoping that you'll drop bombs on the next mafia across the next border.
Yeah.
And when history gets to that point and people choose to live that way, there are periods in history in which God says, you know what, that's the end of it. I've given you far more time to repent of this nonsense. I've given you far more time to return to sense and common sense and love for your neighbor and to create a society based on the principles I've given you. And so he inflicts judgments in history. And I would say the number's far beyond 3.5 million. It's probably far higher than that. I was just thinking about this.
I was told on a show yesterday about the monkey experiment where they got five monkeys in a basement and put some bananas up the top of the stairs. And as soon as one monkey goes for the bananas, they spray every monkey with cold water. And eventually, yes, they stop going for it because every monkey that tries, they beat them up. So they start replacing the monkeys out one by one. And the new monkey will go up, try to get the bananas, and the other monkeys will beat him up. And then he'll stop trying to go get it. and then they'll introduce a new one, and a new one, and a new one, until eventually there's not a single monkey there that's ever been sprayed with water. They're all just beating each other up, preventing them to go for the bananas, because that's the way it's always been done. And that's not entirely dissimilar from how public schooling works, not entirely dissimilar from how belief in statism works, not entirely dissimilar from how people could view everything in their life, whether that be feminism, chauvinism, any form of ism, really. Oh, yes, it's just the way it's always been.
Of course, I heard that experiment, too. It's really eye-opening, and it's powerful. It's a testimony to the power of tradition, and brainwashing is what it is. And I would add to your long list there religion as well. I mean, I'm sitting here speaking as a Bible scholar on behalf of the Bible and particular view of Christianity, but you know, we're not exempt either. I mean, our guys have screwed up and sometimes royally in history and have used scripture and used scriptural principles as means of tyranny just as much as anything else, because it is a powerful means of social control. And you can get all people thinking one way, it's easy to move them as a herd. And so, like you said, whether that's feminism or chauvinism, whatever ideology it may be, it becomes a powerful tool of statism. And that's why I think it's important to go back and look at the social theory that's embedded in biblical law, biblical history, and the teachings of Jesus, and realize this is a strongly anti-state message here, because that is the one place where we can stop this. Even if you have all the people holding one set of beliefs or one set of goals or whatever, you're not supposed to have a state where you can coerce people, whether it's through money, whether it's, as they say, through the carrot or the stick, to herd them into doing mass evil, whether it's warfare or programs like public schooling or welfare, whatever.
You know how difficult it would be, so difficult to force to get everybody to totally agree with everything you say and go off and kill people if they all thought for themselves and didn't believe authority blindly. And that was
absolutely,
I mean, these are the two principles I believe should be taught in every school until such a time as we don't need these frickin' schools anymore. In my opinion, that they're probably enforcing their own need right now. It's kind of like if you start feeding a pigeon out of a hole in the side of the wall or something like that, and he thinks every time he presses that button he'll get some reward for it. That's kind of how the school works. You'll never learn how to fly and gather your own seed.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, so to speak, at this point in history. And it really was designed that way. In my book, Restoring America, One County at a Time, I have a whole chapter on education, and I talk about what I mentioned earlier. Before 1830 in the United States, there were no government schools. Everybody was either homeschooled or went to a private tutor or was educated in a church. And so I think 1830 is not that long ago. It's not that ancient history, you know, and even by the time you get to the Civil War, you've only got a few hundred public schools versus several thousand private schools in the United States. So it took a while. It was not until the late 19th century that you really had a turn toward public schooling. And so the question is, how do we lose that mentality? How do we go from being a free people who would never succumb to the concept of government education funded by property taxes, which is just unbelievable tyranny in the eyes of our founders, and go through the Civil War, come up just, I mean, less than 100 years later, and the next thing you know, public schooling is the norm, and there are very few people living who didn't understand anything else. Well, how do we make that transition?
There's an old lesson, I think, in history here, that no generation is any more than one or two generations away from tyranny.
Absolutely. That was a famous quote from Reagan, something to that effect, who was also something of a tyrant himself.
Hey, I made up a joke about that. What do hardcore right-wingers put in their spaghetti bolognese?
I haven't heard.
Oregano.
Just keep that one to yourself at the dinner party. Shakespeare said that...
Apparently it's a very fragrant herb.
Yeah, puns are the death of wit, but that's all right.
Incidentally, hates other herbs.
So,
particularly psychoactive ones. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, no, so I'm talking about this issue of education, especially historically, and how did we get to this point? And I look back, and there were you know, there were several explanations for things that took place, and one of the big ones was the advent of the Industrial Revolution, and you had the tremendous advance of giant corporations in American history. Of course, it happened all over the industrialized West, and once the corporations got a hold of things, they needed workers. They needed assembly line workers, especially. So they became tremendous proponents of public schooling, because public schooling was really this mechanism for turning out these little automatons who didn't think for themselves, who didn't question their existence in life, who were taught from day one over the process of 12 years of schooling that you get up when you're told to get up, you sit down when you're told to sit down, you be quiet. When the bell rings, you go to the bathroom. When the bell rings again, you get a drink of water. When it rings again, you have lunch. You know, when the bell rings, so we're talking about Pavlov's dogs here. When the bell rings, you go sit back deck at your desk and you be quiet, you do your work, you do what you're told. And at the end of 12 years of this nonsense, you've got a guy who doesn't question his existence. He falls in line. He knows how to walk in a single file line. He knows how to take orders. And these people left the graduation table, the graduation ceremony in high school, and walked right into the next building, which is the nearest factory, and applied for a job and went into the assembly line. And it was the exact same thing over and over. When the bell rang, you did what you're supposed to do. And you went to lunch, you went to the bathroom, you got your drink of water. You didn't question your existence. And so during the late 19th century, you had a tremendous change between the types of mentalities of people who had founded this country and the people who later became what was called the Gilded Age of American history, which is one of the great misnomers in American history. It was a takeover of the corporations. And then by the time you get to the turn of the century, last century, you have basically what was the fascist state before the term was used to describe fascist states. So, I mean, I'm rambling here, but the point is there are many forces in society that want to keep people dumb. And it's the government, it's the state, it is the leftists, it's several ideologies, and it is the corporations. I just put out an article today on corporate subsidies. It's just mind-blowing to think that over the past 10-year span, I think it was, that there have been $1.2 trillion in direct corporate subsidies in the United States. I'm not even talking about indirect things like tax breaks and whatnot. I'm talking about direct handouts, direct loans, direct guarantees, etc., to the top 100 countries in this companies in this country, and it still goes on, and it's the status quo. And freedom will never be gained as long as there's this stranglehold on society by the government, the banks, and the corporations.
Joel, have you looked into the research and the documentaries of Clint Richardson, The Corporation Nation?
No, I don't guess I have.
You and him would get along really, really well. He's looked into the SEC and the background, and what you said just then reminded me of what his research found, is that the U.S. government actually has a major shareholding in the top companies in America. They own like 30% of McDonald's and like 40% of GE and or something like that. Like, basically, the reason why these governments are giving these handouts and everything is they're actually doing it in exchange for stock. And people don't realize that the government actually already owns major shareholdings in all these massive companies which people think are private.
Well, I'd definitely be interested in taking a look at that, because that's
it's socialism by stealth.
If nothing else, I mean, the fact that many of these large corporations are holding government bonds as a tremendous part of their portfolios and assets is says.
And I wonder who told them to do that.
and they're taught from day one that that's the safest investment to make that there is. Period. Backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, which means the barrel of the United States government's gun. But you know, like you were saying, they're hand and fist, and that's why I call it fascism, because that's what fascism is. One of the major facets of fascism, I can't even speak those words at the same time, apparently, is this alliance between the national government and the corporate state, the corporations, national corporations, however you want to put it, and that alliance, and it becomes over time a revolving door. The cabinets and the bureaucratic positions in government end up being peopled by the executives who take a leave of absence for 8 years to go work in the Bush administration or whatever, you know. And so you get these guys who are Monsanto lawyers ending up on the Supreme Court deciding cases in favor of Monsanto. You get guys that are working for the FDA that were executives for the drug companies and all that kind of stuff. It's just a revolving door over and over, and you can find it in many places. And when you have that relationship and nobody really has a good plan or strategy or ability to break through and put an end to it, it's just a recipe for tyranny. And the greatest hope you can have is that someday it runs out of other people's money to keep going, that you have some kind of national bankruptcy. But in the meantime, you know, I look at all that and I can get upset about it. And I do like to keep my finger on its pulse to know what's going on. But when I look at it, I think, yeah, I can't change that. You know, I can talk about it on the radio and that's fine. Somebody may hear it that can do something. That's great. I'll be the first one to preach wherever I have the opportunity to preach. And yet the main things I can do are to speak to my local government, train my own children, you know, keep my own backyard in line, and to look for opportunities to serve other people, because, you know, that's what's been put in front of me. If, for example, you know, God somehow put me in a position to be governor of the state of Georgia, well, I'd obviously have a much larger platform. But until that day comes, I speak to who I'm given to speak to, and that is my wife, my children, the people in my church, the people in my neighborhood, community, and the people who follow me in my ministry online and on Facebook, on social media. And it's encouraging in those circles to see that when you start small and you be faithful in what you're doing and consistent, that you do make small headway. And when you consider that there are other people doing this, it's not just me, it's you. And it's not just you, it's me. And it's the people listening to you, and it's the guy who's our mutual friend who recommended us both. You know, these networks go out there for a long way, and each one of these people is doing what they can where they can. And the great miracle, if I can use that word, that God's given us in our generation is the internet, is this great massive decentralization of power when it comes to media and information. And I'd never heard of Lou Rockwell before, I think it was 1999 or so, when he put his website up, or when someone forwarded me on via email or website a link to his site. And he's, you know, you probably know about Lou Rockwell and the Mises Institute. Here's a libertarian and anarcho-capitalist think tank. Who would have ever thought there would even be such a thing? And it's got hundreds of thousands of followers, if not millions of followers worldwide. And that would have been unthinkable 40 years ago, or even 30 years ago. And so the web has given us this decentralization of power, and it's beginning to chip away at the power of the great state alliances. I mean, you look at Wikipedia or WikiLeaks. I mean, whatever small things he's accomplished, I mean, here's one guy with a thumb drive who put the entire nation, National Security Agency, in a frenzy. They're scared to death over this stuff. They're mobilizing international governments to arrest the guy over
This is Snowden we're talking about, eh? Because he was just in a public meeting here in New Zealand not a few days ago, exposing how much the NSA is actually in this country to this day. And we've just found out through a number of sources that these cables that the NSA are coming into are going directly into New Zealand military bases, where they have secret spy centers and things of that nature. These are the allegations. We've got to confirm the reports first, because I'm probably going to go out to the air base at Whenuapai, just north of where I am now, with a giant megaphone and go, "Hey, bro, have you guys got any super secret spy crap in there that you're trying to hide? You know, is it?
Yeah.
No, you don't have any super secret spy stuff. I suppose you wouldn't tell me if you did, no."
Yeah, and in a way, it's kind of quite laughable because you've got a major international intelligence agency spying on another major international intelligence agency or government. And yeah. And what are they accomplishing by doing this? They're just showing what big goofs they are.
Yeah.
And then you got a guy like Snowden who can take a thumb drive and just crash their party and put them running in circles like the old proverbial, forgive my racism, Chinese fire drill.
Yeah.
You know, and
I mean, it gives a whole new meaning to thumbs up their asses, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'd like to see a whole lot more of those, actually.
Well, Rogel, unfortunately, we have run out of time for the broadcast today. I would really love it if you'd quickly plug your own works and services. And I'm chatting with Clint Richardson from the Corporation Nation off air right now as we speak as well. So we're going to get you two together, and he's going to interview you on his radio show. How about them apples?
Hey, that sounds great. Like I said earlier, we're making those relationships work, right? I'm Joel McDermott. I work for the American Vision. You can find my website at AmericanVision.org. We post articles almost daily on topics like this. We have all kinds of resources for us, ranging the spectrum from Christian apologetics to Christian ethics and America's Christian history and all kinds of government and political issues. One of my latest books was Restoring America One County at a Time. All kinds of good stuff in there. You can find it all at AmericanVision.org. And, Vinny, I appreciate you having me on the show.
Thank you so much for your time, Joel. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in to this particular broadcast. Thank you so much for doing it. We have a number of sponsors that we'd really love you to check out. The Blue Shield to protect yourself from EMF and EMR radiation. Not entirely sure if it'll dissipate the scumbaggery of the scumbags that rule over you, but you never know. Other than that, this is a listener-supported broadcast, and it would be very much appreciative if you go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, and if you are a New Zealand listener, please have a look at that Kiwi Bank there and consider making a monthly donation of $5 or more. And if you happen to be overseas, there is a PayPal option for you available there as well. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you again sometime.